I am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading today from presidential historian Michael Betzlaus's Presidents of War and his essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and World War II. We pick up the story with Franklin Roosevelt in the summer of 1944 having to make a decision as to who to replace as his vice presidential running mate, Henry Wallace, and the discussion is centered on Missouri Senator Harry Truman. Roosevelt is in poor health, and the war is coming to a conclusion. At a White House meeting, the Democratic National Chairman, Robert Hannigan, eager for a less audacious selection, proposed instead his fellow Missourian Harry Truman to run on the ticket as vice president in the 1944 presidential election in November. "I hardly know Truman," said Franklin Roosevelt. Preferring a younger running mate, he asked how old the senator was. After consulting the congressional directory and finding that the Missourian was 60, another Truman backer, who was present, hoped that the president would not ask again. Roosevelt observed that Douglas would have more public appeal, but that Truman would make you boys happy, and you're the ones I'm counting on to win this election. He scrawled on paper that either Douglas or Truman would bring real strength to the ticket. Afterwards, Hannigan asked Roosevelt's secretary, Grace Tully, to have the note typed, claiming that the president actually preferred Truman's name to come first. Tully forged her boss's initials on the document, and Hannigan showed it around, claiming that Truman was really Roosevelt's choice. The president appreciated Harry Truman's restraint as chairman of the Senate Special Committee that had probed Roosevelt's defense programs. Roosevelt knew that the Missourian could help him in the isolationist Midwest and as a popular member of the Senate's inner club in ratifying post-war treaties. He sprang the trap door under Wallace by sending him on a trip to China, which distanced him from his supporters and generated further confusion by beckoning others into the race for the number two slot on the ticket. Publicly, Roosevelt claimed that he would vote for Henry Wallace were he a delegate at the convention, while privately warning the vice president, Henry Wallace, on his return from China that there would be catcalls and humiliation should his name be presented to the delegates at the convention. During convention week in Chicago, when told of President Roosevelt's interest in him, Harry Truman at first stalled, anxious that such new national prominence might provoke the press to investigate the long-ago suicide of his wife Bess' father, as well as her presence on his Senate payroll as an employee. Then from the Blackstone Hotel, Hannigan placed a call in Truman's presence to the president, who warned that if the Missouri senator wants to break up the Democratic Party in the middle of a war, that's his responsibility. After Roosevelt rang off, Truman exclaimed, "Oh, shit." The president accepted his fourth-term nomination by radio from his railroad car near the San Diego Naval Base, which for security reasons the press agreed to call a Pacific Coast base. He argued that Americans must now decide whether to give this worldwide job to an inexperienced or immature hands, or to those who saw the danger from abroad, who met it head-on, who have now seized the offensive, and carried the war to its present stages of success. Aboard the heavy cruiser Baltimore, Roosevelt sailed for Hawaii, where he would view the sunken wreckage at Pearl Harbor and confer with his Pacific commander, Douglas MacArthur, who had toyed with running against Roosevelt that year. When his ship reached Honolulu, the president asked, "Where is MacArthur?" The general roared up late, with screaming sirens and motorcycles, in a fire engine red convertible that, as it happened, had been borrowed from a local bordello. Long familiar with MacArthur's act, Roosevelt took him down a peg by asking, "What are you doing with that leather jacket on? It's damn hot today." The general explained that he had flown from pretty cold weather in Australia. During their private meetings, by MacArthur's account, the president confided to him, If the war with Germany ends before the election, I will not be reelected. Returning to Washington, sitting under the Andrew Jackson magnolia behind the White House, the president lunched on sandwiches and vanilla ice cream with Senator Harry Truman, both wearing shirt sleeves. Roosevelt's grandson, Curtis, who joined them for part of the meal, felt that the president was looking for character traits, hoping to confirm that Truman was the kind of person who might continue his liberal policies. Roosevelt told Truman that he hoped to be succeeded by someone who was a little right of center, because after a time of activism, you have to digest it. Shocked by how much Roosevelt had aged since he had seen him a year earlier, Harry Truman later told a friend, "It doesn't seem to be a mental lapse, but physically he's just going to pieces." Told that soon he would be living in the White House, Harry Truman replied, "I'm afraid I am, and it scares the hell out of me." In September, while meeting with Churchill at Quebec City, the president ordered an after-dinner screening of 20th Century Fox's new film, Wilson, starring Alexander Knox. Roosevelt hoped that the picture would encourage moviegoers to embrace his imagined post-war peace organization. While watching his old chief on the screen, Woodrow Wilson, collapse from a stroke while fighting for his League of Nations, Roosevelt swore, "By God, that's not going to happen to me." When the film was over, his doctor discovered that the president's blood pressure had shot up dangerously. Back in Washington, Roosevelt was alarmed to learn that Thomas Dewey of New York was planning to exploit secret information to claim that the president had deliberately encouraged the Pearl Harbor attack to get America into the war. Roosevelt's new Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, advised him that some Army officer had told Dewey's aides that before the assault, Roosevelt and his chiefs had been privy to decoded Japanese cable traffic showing that Tokyo was targeting the Hawaiian base. General George Marshall cautioned that if the Republican nominee, Thomas Dewey, used the information, the result would be loaded with dynamite. Without telling Roosevelt, Marshall sent the Pentagon's chief of cryptography, Colonel Carter Clark, to see Thomas Dewey, who was campaigning in Oklahoma. Carter Clark bore a letter from George Marshall, which he was supposed to read to the governor, but only if Dewey pledged in advance that he would not share its content with others. Disinclined to silence himself, Dewey refused to offer such blind commitments. He asked Clark, on his honor, to confirm that George Marshall had not sent him at the president's behest. Clark did so, but Thomas Dewey insisted that Franklin Roosevelt is behind the whole thing. He complained that Washington had intercepted certain Jap codes before Pearl Harbor, and two of them are still in current use. Dewey blustered that Roosevelt knew what was happening before Pearl Harbor, and instead of being reelected, he ought to be impeached. Disturbed by Clark's failure, Marshall sent him to see Dewey again, this time in Albany, New York, with a new written warning that if the governor divulged the Pearl Harbor secrets he knew, it would help the enemy, German or Jap, and damage the interests of our armed forces. In the note, George Marshall conceded that for years the U.S. government had decoded Japanese diplomatic messages which had revealed their moves in the Pacific, but unfortunately made no reference whatever to intentions towards Hawaii, except for a dispatch that did not reach our hands until after Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Marshall went on to confide that the Pentagon was still acquiring crucial information about both German and Japanese intentions from channels still using the same code, which would stop if Thomas Dewey revealed the code breaking to the public. After Clark departed, Thomas Dewey, white-faced in anger, told his campaign manager, Herbert Brownell, and other close aides that Roosevelt was a traitor. Dewey said he would be damned if I believed the Japs are still using those codes, and claimed that at least 12 senators knew about the information that Marshall was imploring him to withhold. Herbert Brownell warned Dewey that if he seemed to be publicizing Pearl Harbor secrets, Roosevelt could charge in response that his opponent had handed information to the enemy. Dewey felt deeply frustrated to be forced to let the potent issues slip through his fingers. When the president later heard from his aide, Harry Hopkins, about Marshall's quiet intervention in the campaign, he observed that Thomas Dewey must be pretty desperate if he is even thinking of using material like this, which would be bound to react against him. With the prospect of a campaign uproar over Pearl Harbor dispelled, Roosevelt moved to silence talk about his health. He told his cabinet there was this constant rumor that I'll not live if I'm elected, adding that you all know that's not so, but apparently Papa has to tell them. In a public display of stamina on Saturday, October 23rd, wearing his Navy cap and lucky campaign fedora on his head, he was driven in his open car under a cold rain for 51 miles through all five boroughs of New York City. Eleanor Roosevelt later recalled that she was really worried about him that day, but instead of being completely exhausted, Roosevelt was exhilarated. That evening at the Waldorf Astoria, Roosevelt spoke at a dinner of the Foreign Policy Association over national radio, warning that if the Republicans were to win control of the Congress in November, inveterate isolationists would occupy positions of commanding influence and power. He boasted that he lacked the support of the isolationist press, naming such publishers as William Randolph Hearst and the Chicago Tribune's Robert McCormick. At that moment, MacArthur had just made his triumphal return to the Philippines. On Tuesday, November 7th, the president defeated Thomas Dewey of New York by a popular majority of almost 8%, with an electoral landslide of 432-99 votes. Democrats lost one Senate seat, but gained 20 in the House. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was sworn in as president for the fourth time in January 1945 on the south portico of the White House. Since Americans were still dying abroad, he had asked for a more modest setting than the Capitol. Roosevelt did not wish to bear the physical toll of a large ceremony. Asked if there would be a military parade, he replied that the soldiers were off fighting. Who was there here to parade? One of the guests was Edith Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's widow, now 72 years old, who was shocked to note that Roosevelt looked exactly as my husband did when he went into his decline. Delivering history's second briefest inaugural address, the president used language that sounded like that of Edith Wilson's husband during his Western trip of 1919 in support of the League of Nations. Roosevelt complained that this world war had taught Americans that our well-being is dependent on the well-being of other nations far away. They must live not as ostriches, nor as dogs in the manger, but as citizens of the world, members of the human community. Roosevelt went on to state, "We have learned the simple truth, as Emerson said, that the only way to have a friend is to be one." After the ceremony, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote Joe Lash, the journalist, that she felt so very depressed because the next years seem impossible to live through. 2 days later, Roosevelt secretly traveled by train to Newport News and departed on the USS Quincy to meet Joseph Stalin and Winston Churchill at the Crimean resort town of Yalta, there to conceive the post-war world. Eleanor Roosevelt was hurt to be left home from a summit once again, this time passed over in favor of their daughter, Anna Roosevelt. When the Big Three met, Stalin tried to maximize Soviet influence in the new United Nations by demanding seats for all 16 Soviet republics in its future General Assembly. Roosevelt countered by requesting similar treatment for all 48 American states. Stalin finally settled for 3 delegates, including the Ukraine and Belarus. Sailing home, the president worried about persuading the U.S. Senate, which he privately described as a bunch of incompetent obstructionists, to empower the United Nations to request American troops to enforce its resolutions without the case-by-case assent of Congress. Aboard the U.S. Quincy, a reporter asked Franklin Roosevelt whether the Yalta agreements would provide peace for the next generation. The president replied, "I can answer that question if you can tell me who your descendants will be in the year 2057. Roosevelt predicted that the United Nations will evolve into the best method ever for stopping war. Going on to state, obviously we could have come to terms with Hitler and we could have accepted a minor role in his totalitarian world. We could have compromised with Japan and bargained for a place in the Japanese-dominated Asia. And we rejected that. The United Nations must have the power to act quickly and decisively to keep the peace by force if necessary. A policeman would not be a very effective policeman if when he saw a felon break into a house, he had to go to the town hall and call a town meeting to issue a warrant before the felon could be arrested. Back from the conference in Yalta with Churchill and Stalin, the exhausted president made his final appearance before Congress on March 1, 1945. No longer concealing his disability, he sat down at a table in front of the podium in the House chamber, explained that it makes it a lot easier for me not to have to carry about 10 pounds of steel around the bottom of my legs. At the end of the month, seeking rejuvenation, he traveled to his little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia, joined by Polly Delano and Daisy Suckley. The First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote her aunt, Maud Gray, "I say a prayer daily that he may be able to carry on till we have peace and our feet are set in the right direction." On April 8, 1945, she wrote to Franklin Roosevelt, "You sounded cheerful for the first time last night, and I hope you'll weigh 170 pounds when you return to the White House." Before going to bed at the little White House, the president on several nights engaged in a small pantomime that showed the maternal place of Suckley and Delano in his life. As Daisy Suckley wrote in her diary, "I get the gruel and Polly and I take it to him. I sit on the edge of the bed and he puts on an act. He's too weak to raise his head. His hands are weak. He must be fed. So I proceed to feed him with a teaspoon, and he loves it. Just to be able to run from his world problems and behave like a complete nut for a few moments with an appreciative audience laughing with him and at him both." On the last evening of Franklin Roosevelt's life, Henry Morgenthau, his Secretary of Treasury, came to dinner at the cottage at the Little White House. By now there was an additional house guest, Lucy Rutherford. When the Treasury Secretary arrived, he was terribly shocked to find that his old friend had aged terrifically and looked very haggard and was constantly confusing names. Roosevelt related that 2 weeks hence, he would take his train to San Francisco for the opening session of the United Nations, stating, "I will appear on the stage in my wheelchair. They will applaud me, and I will be back in Hyde Park, New York, on May 1st. The next morning, Thursday, April 12th, the president posed for an oil portrait in the company of Delano, Suckley, and Lucy Rutherford. Daisy noted that Franklin looked smiling and happy and ready for anything. He told the ladies that the war in Europe could end at any time and tossed his draft card into the wastebasket. Suckley sat on the sofa, crocheting, while Delano left to pour water into a bowl of roses in her bedroom. Suddenly the president's head pitched forward, and Daisy asked, "Have you dropped your cigarette?" With clenched brow, trying to smile, he replied, "I have a terrific pain in the back of my head." The two women tipped his chair backward, and someone called for a doctor. As Roosevelt was carried to his narrow bed, he murmured to Polly his last known words, "Be careful." Rutherford held camphor to his nostrils. Then, hoping to escape attention, she climbed into a car and sped away, not to be found at the Little White House. At 3:35 in the evening, the president died from a cerebral hemorrhage. That evening, when the First Lady arrived, she was stunned when Polly told her that Lucy Rutherford, who Franklin Roosevelt had pledged never to see again, had been present at the death scene. After midnight, the undertakers pulled a sheet away that find that someone had tied a strip of gauze under Roosevelt's chin and around his head to keep his lower jaw from dropping open. In May 1945, after Adolf Hitler's suicide and the Allied conquest of Berlin, the Germans surrendered unconditionally. That August, President Harry Truman ordered American bombers to drop atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Japan begged for peace. At the end of World War II, American military deaths were established at 405,399, out of an estimated global military death count of about 25 million. In December, the Senate voted 65-7 for full participation in the United States, as did the House by a vote of 344-15. Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., grandson of the enemy of Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations, and who had resigned from the Senate to fight Hitler in Europe, said he backed the United Nations in every possible way. By the 21st century, some Americans would think of the wartime resident primarily in terms of the mistakes that led to the Pearl Harbor disaster, the removal of Japanese Americans and other infringements of civil liberties, the failure to significantly improve the lot of African Americans and do more to thwart the Holocaust. Although more than some of such criticism is justified, the 32nd president deserves the verdict of the New York Times newspaper, rendered the morning after his death, that men will thank God on their knees 100 years from now that Franklin D. Roosevelt was in the White House. It is difficult to imagine any other American leader of that generation guiding with such success a resistant nation towards intervention and ultimate victory in this momentous of history's wars, as well as taking Americans into a post-war assembly that would strive to enforce the peace. This feat would have been difficult for Roosevelt to accomplish without his experiencing watching Woodrow Wilson's achievements and failures at close hand as he served as Assistant Secretary of Navy during World War I, which showed him how to build a domestic wartime leviathan, as well as how not to deal with Congress in seeking a post-war peace organization. In public, Roosevelt referred to the tragic mistakes and the ill-fated experiments of former years. While waging World War II, Roosevelt appeared so self-assured that it seemed he had been through it all before, and in a sense, he had. If Roosevelt had not persuaded the nation to rearm before Pearl Harbor, the Allies might conceivably have lost the war. After the Japanese assault, his conspicuous personal self-confidence, through the public hysteria and beyond, was a powerful weapon of war. A president more psychologically insecure would not have been able to reassure his country that the Allies would fight through to absolute victory. Unlike Woodrow Wilson's public silence through much of his war, Roosevelt gave repeated press conferences and speeches and spoke on radio, informing Americans about the current state of battle, both good and alarming. By contrast with what had seemed like Wilson's kingly remove, Roosevelt relentlessly cajoled members of Congress to accede to his plans for war and peace. Emulating Abraham Lincoln, as the conflict ground on, Roosevelt lifted his war aims to a higher moral plane, eloquently citing his Four Freedoms and post-war economic Bill of Rights. Roosevelt's commanding performance throughout World War II rescued his reputation and pushed it to near the top of the presidential ladder. Had there been no war, and had he retired in 1941, he would have been known as a president who employed government activism to save his country from the worst of the Great Depression, but who, despite his landslide reelection, was blocked by Congress during his second term and never managed to fix the economic crisis. As late as 1938, U.S. unemployment was 19%, and the country was suffering from recession. It was Roosevelt's rearmament program that managed to stimulate the economy and put the jobless to work. Without it, that two-term president might today be widely viewed as a failure, with the term Rooseveltian leadership a synonym for ineffectuality. The war ultimately did so much to elevate Roosevelt's standing that it increased the temptation for later presidents to escalate their reputations by seeking foreign conflict. The result of Americans' triumph in the survival war and Roosevelt's role in it was a quantum increase in presidential power. As the custodian of nuclear weapons, a president now had the almost instant power, with little time to consult Congress or the public, to take the nation to war and cause untold numbers of deaths. With the advent of the Cold War against the Soviet Union, the apparatus of national security built to fight the Axis was preserved and expanded into a permanent war machine. For the next three decades, the United States was the world's preeminent superpower, and many Americans felt they could do anything. The experience of the late 1930s and early 1940s suggested to much of the country that the isolationist Congress had been wrong and Roosevelt was right, and that presidents should be granted dominance on matters of war. Roosevelt's vision of a post-war United Nations presented a means of dealing with future world conflicts that might spiral into another world war. But when Congress authorized American membership in the United Nations, it never quite resolved the problem that had vexed the opponents of Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations, that obligations to such an organization, augmented by an elaborate network of international treaties, might draw an overstretched United States into peripheral wars against adversaries who did not directly or immediately threaten American security. With Congress eager to pass the buck on questions of war, Americans, as never before, were willing to entrust such decisions primarily to their presidents, as history was about to witness later in Korea and Vietnam. This concludes Michael Beschloss's essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and World War II in his presence of war. Reading will continue. This is Wallace Klingdienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.